want to begin again with the lady who was most helpful for me, as I've worked with individuals in different contexts. Just briefly, my background has put me in the context of as the parish ministry for about 10 years, and I was a chaplain of VA center. In fact, I was the chaplain of the first Vietnam Veterans Ward. The hospital itself was connected to a medical school, and I was able to do a lot of training with their residents in what's called psychodynamic theory and marriage and family therapy. And they were also developing this concept at this time called PTSD. And I'm sure you've heard that. And our hospital was a key hospital in that process. And it was a very learning process for me as I listen. I have a big spot in my heart for Vietnam vets. And at that time, it was viewed as bad soldier, good war. But we more view it now as good soldier, bad war. And they experienced a lot of ambiguous loss. Tried to work with them, tried to understand them, tried to help them. And then from there, as a consequence, I had developed some more credentials and a degree. So I was able to start a pastoral counseling center in Central Florida. And was there for about 27 years and developed it, and have been retired from there about 4 years. And I was also a chaplain in the Army Reserve for many years, which put me in contact with a lot of families who were deployed, a lot of soldiers, and their issues around ambiguous losses in their lives, as well as my work that I did as a therapist, a pastoral counselor. I learned as people, you know, presented their life stories, as they do in communities, as they come for help, I was hearing some over and over again that this concept of ambiguous loss seems to fit. And when I learned about it in the about 15 years ago, I said, aha, aha. Pauline Voss was a researcher in University of Minnesota. She did qualitative research. And from our own life story, being the daughter of a woman who migrated from Norway, and her mother really never left home emotionally, but she raised Pauline here in the United States. So in her own research, she began to help her own life story have more sense and have more meaning to it. Dr. Voss died a couple of years ago. She's written two books primarily, one of which is Ambiguous Loss. That was the first one. And the second one, in fact, I have it here. It's not that big. The second one is more of a more academically oriented, and we'll get more of that stuff on Friday. So, those of you who are just one quote that I pulled from her book that I think is very important. Lee, would you read that, please? Or Carol?
Sure. Everyone experiences ambiguous loss, if only from breaking up with someone or having aging parents or kids leaving home. As we learn from the people who must cope with the more catastrophic situations of ambiguous loss, we learn how to tolerate the ambiguity in our own more common losses in everyday life.
It's these catastrophic situations that kind of help us to understand the concept. And we'll be getting into that a little bit more. I find that the book of Ecclesiastes, and I had spent some time on this on Monday, the word time here is familiar. The familiar, for everything there is a season. The word time is found 27 times. And how we understand time, I think, is significant. As a pastor, as an ELCA pastor, it is, I look at things both from a faith perspective, both from a theological training perspective, as well as from a clinical perspective. And I think this concept of time and how it's viewed is important as we live with ambiguous loss, how we understand time. The distinction here is that in the Old Testament, the Hebrew understanding of time is like a bowl to be filled. It's qualitative. It's like a stew that you put in a crock pot, and you have the right ingredients, and you give it a time to melt together and come together, and to create its own uniqueness, which is different than a quantitative Greek orientation of time, which is more like a measurement. It's more like a ruler that we assess time, and also it's, you know, about 50 minutes. It's a quantitative issue, but I'll be letting you go. Okay? About time. When you're 57 years old, the doctor says, I'd like to have you get that down a bit. Our bowls of time are filled with ambiguous losses. And what do I mean by ambiguous loss? Is that it's a loss that is unclear, not concrete, can have different meanings. Can have different meanings. And others often do not see or give it the same meaning. Others may not even be aware of it. May not even be aware of it.
Well, the first one, you had ambiguous loss, like a breaking up or parents getting old. Those seem to be kind of concrete reasons for loss. That's what I'm...
Well, that's true. But within that, within the aging process, there are losses. You know, mother no longer makes homemade bread.
Okay.
And that brought all sense of warmth and security and hugs and memories. So someone tries to make it for her and doesn't do the job. It doesn't create the same feeling. You know what I didn't do, those of you, there are so many of you who are new. That gentleman, what's your name?
Nick.
Huh?
Nick.
Nick. Been here many times. How about the rest of you? How many times have you been here, those of you who are new?
This is the fourth.
To Holden Village?
This is the fourth time.
Fourth time, okay. And where are you from?
Seattle area.
Seattle?
I think this is my eighth time.
Oh, okay.
Seattle.
So, wow.
All right, and your home?
Seattle.
All of you, so you know each other?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wayne. Seattle, first time actually.
Okay. Anybody brand new this time?
Yes. I'm Val, I'm Nick's wife.
Okay.
Been here probably 20 some times.
That's amazing.
From Wisconsin, never been here.
Okay. Welcome. Okay. Yeah, all of you, welcome. We get to this point that there are two types of ambiguous loss. Two types of ambiguous loss. The first one is when the object of emotional attachment is physically absent, but psychologically present. Turn that inside out, turn that around. The other one is where that person, that object, is physically present, but psychologically absent. Okay.
Are you using the word psychologically, like emotional?
Emotional, yes, yes, uh-huh. Physically absent, but psychologically or emotionally present. Yeah. The catastrophic ones really help to concretize the idea here. Missing in action. Missing from a disaster. One of the experiences that occurred with our counseling service, Florida, I'm from Florida, Central Florida, Orlando, we have this weather phenomenon called hurricanes. And we had a whole bunch of them come through 2004, last year, or we had, the year before, we had Hurricane Irma. And after Katrina, the Lutheran Church used some of my staff and myself to work with congregations who were blown away, basically, from Alabama to Mississippi to Louisiana. So missing from disasters was really, homes were missing, you know. Lifetime possessions were no longer there. Could they be found? Because there was a lot of debris up north. Kidnapping, hostages, a disappearance. I have a cousin who's a few years younger than me, had an adopted son who at age 16, 17 got involved in drugs and one day didn't return home. And he hasn't returned home since then. Incarceration. Okay. Can you think of, or any questions in regard to that? And you may be familiar with this book, which I recently read, called Where the Crawdads Sing. It was on the New York's bestseller. Yeah. Wonderful, gripping book. I tend not to read nonfiction, but man, that one kept my interest. It was written by Delilah Owens, but the key character, this Kaya, was like a seven-year-old, and the setting is in North Carolina, in the lowland areas where the crawdads sing. And the author has a wonderful way of describing her background. The author's background is a naturalist. And she describes the environment so beautiful. And if you've been to that part of the world, be it South Carolina, North Carolina, and it's a beautiful part of the country. And separate from the story, that was engaging, but the story itself was a seven-year-old, and over a period of time, because of an abusive father, I think it was a family of seven, including her mother, they leave. They walk out, and you have this seven-year-old who has to fend for herself. And it's a gripping story, and how it ends is makes it worthwhile to read the whole thing. But she's a catastrophic example of someone being physically absent, and yet in the story it conveys how emotionally she recalls and remembers. And so I use that. If you like to read nonfiction, I would recommend that. Some of the more common aspects is a relationship loss or divorce. I see some of you shaking your head, you know, if I'm capturing something that you have a life experience and you can relate, that you feel comfortable relating, please do so.
Well, I have something that's catastrophic. My father was a prisoner of war in Russia when I grew up.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I was born in 42 in Russia. And so we had to flee because of the Russian invasion. And so he couldn't leave with us, so he stayed behind. And so he went to Russia for 3 years. And so we didn't know if he was still alive. Came back after 3 years. His house was full.
That's an excellent example. That's a relationship loss, divorce.
Both my new husband and I are going through, we both lost our former mate's cancer, and we're going through that whole situation. And it just is inevitable that, you know, the memories come in so often of the person who is lost, and sometimes it's difficult emotionally in the relationship because when those memories come back, they don't tell you they're coming. All of a sudden they're right in your face and not necessarily at an appropriate time. So that's something we're kind of dealing with.
That's so true. That's well said. Relocation. We have a mobile society. Yeah. They figure, the last statistic I saw, so if someone works for over 7 years at the same job, that's long. That's supposed to be empty nest, not empty next. maybe empty next is a better way to say it. I don't know. How many of you experienced empty nest? Yeah. The deployment. Well, yes. And the distinction in the recent wars that we've had, the Iraq War in particular, is the reservists and the National Guard were used heavily. Reservists and the National Guard, their families live in the community. Active military, they live on a base, which is comprised of all sorts of support systems. Reservists and National Guards don't have that. Quite often, their next-door neighbor may not know that they're gone. There may be some strong feeling about we shouldn't be in this war. So that sense of acceptance of dealing with their ambiguous loss becomes amplified. And the soldiers don't make the decisions on going to war. Those are done by the politicians. And especially with the children, they, not able to understand the significance of what's happening, except they know that daddy's not there, or mother's not there. And I've worked with situations where both mother and dad were not there. Yeah. Deployment, separations, for instance, separations from grandkids. My wife and I have our 7-year-old granddaughter with us here. She's a delight most of the time. And she lives in Seattle, and she has a brother a few years younger. So, separations from grandkids. Okay, this has all to do with people, more or less. But if you extend an understanding of this, even changes in worship forms, if you've ever been involved in that, those of you who are clergy have that experience, possibly. Letting go. How much you want to change?
I have a good example of that. Our pastor, who we've had for 27 years, or 22 years, whatever it is, in May was elected bishop. And so, yes, it's a person, but now that we're transitioning to a new pastor who, you know, we have no idea who it's going to be, and we've got interim pastor, so everything in worship is just a little different than it used to be. Yeah.
It's asking you to stretch.
It is.
Yeah. How about new political leadership?
Oh, yeah.
See the rumbling in the crowd here, huh?
Catastrophic.
Say it again.
Catastrophic.
That falls into catastrophic. Okay. Okay. Catastrophic versus the more common. And we tend to, now there are some experiences, of course, where the catastrophic has been part of our life experience, but the more common, and as we allow ourselves to work with this concept, others will boil up and come to our consciousness. Now let's look at it from the other side, where the object of emotional attachment is physically present, but psychologically or emotionally absent. And the catastrophic ones, most families most directly or indirectly have the experience of Alzheimer's and dementia. We lost my father-in-law. He had Alzheimer's. And my mother-in-law was a number of years younger than him, but she cared for him. And Alzheimer's, horrible. The person is still physically there, but emotionally gone. May not even know the name. Chronic mental illness. How many of you have ever worked with mentally ill?
I am mentally ill. I live with depression.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and you know, my comment on that, that's quite a statement to say that, is in some sense or another, we're all mentally ill.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was impressed as we took the boat up here on Saturday. There was a family sitting there, and what caught my notice to begin with, there was a lady, a middle-aged, I'd say she's mid-50s or so, clean, dressed, well-dressed, but no interchange with the other family members. And I noticed what possibly could have been her brother, that he made sure that she had a pill and she wanted to spit it out. And he made sure that she swallowed it. And I watched that family, and she was part of the family, but yet she was not part of the family. And I didn't have an opportunity. I think it would have been a little invasive to say, I really appreciate that, the way you dealt with your family person that was part, because they just went about. She didn't bother anybody, but yet she would. I would imagine she had some form of schizophrenia. Dementias, a traumatic head injury, a coma, where someone's physically present but emotionally absent. The more common would involve like alcoholism, various forms of addictions, where the person is present, of course, but their life is oriented around maintaining their addiction. Secrecy is often involved, as you find in affairs. When depression really hits, one can be really withdrawn. There is no energy. And managing that in the context of family becomes a challenge for the family as well as for the person. Acute grief. And by acute grief, I would mean the loss of someone significant that is very, has a definite end point to it, like a death, where someone lives in isolation and refuses to engage in a world that's without the person that's been lost. Obsessions would be constant watching of TV, overuse of computer, you know, this thing that's in my pocket, cell phones, games that are played, you know, preoccupations. The internet, a particular hobby. I have a friend who is a ham radio. And his wife always complains about he's never there. He's on his ham radio. He loves it. And he talks about it all the time.
We're mumbling in the background here about work.
Yeah. Say it again.
About work. Yeah. About jobs that expect so much time and so much involvement that they create absence.
Well, they create it on site, but there's a tendency to bring it home, too.
I think that's what you're saying. Yeah. Can't get away from it.
Yeah. It's an addiction, you know. Work.
Well, it's even got a term. It's called workaholism.
You are.
Yes.
I work with the father of a foster child that we used to have, and he has been diagnosed with childhood PTSD because of losses of his parents at an early age, and basically had a Cinderella story without a fairy godmother. And he's got all of the more common ones and more. And he requires somebody to talk to in the middle of the night for hours sometimes.
Really? Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are certain professions, too, that are more prone to ambiguous loss. The military is one. Your assignment is for 3 years, and you're working with other people who are in that assignment. You may work with one for 1 year, 2 years, long, or with staff person, and then you're gone. Then you start it up again. And there's a tendency, is because they all live with it, there's a tendency of accept it. But when they leave the military, there's also a tendency of not to create lasting relationships because you know they're not going to last. Mm-hmm. And when you see, I always admire someone who's been in the active military for a period of time who does relocate and establishes relationships. I really admire that kind of person. Okay. What are characteristics unique to ambiguous loss that makes them challenging to live with, yet important to understand?
In the ministry, coming to love people and caring about people that the congregation entrusted to you, and then they die, and you go through the grief of losing people that you care about, you do the funeral, you work with the family, but that loss is always there, but you just have to go on and keep doing it over and over and over again, depending on the age of the congregation.
Yeah.
But it's there, carried.
Any other thoughts?
Well, there can be a tendency to burn out, you know, having too many losses.
A tendency to what?
To burn out.
Oh, burnout.
So
thank you.
I'm a pastor retired and also an LPC retired, you know, so I'm very much aware of the burnout syndrome, you know, and the need to do a lot of self-care.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We did foster care for many years and had a lot of foster kids. And after about the third one, whom I wanted to adopt and we didn't, and to this day, she's still my daughter, but I never see her.
Oh, wow.
I realized that I had to do something to deal with that kind of loss or stop doing it. Mm-hmm. Because it was painful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what I figured out was my expectations were not set correctly. Mm-hmm. And I decided to change my expectations and to be there for the child more than the child be there for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that made the difference.
Yeah.
And I was doing something for that child the child needed. And I was still able to enjoy what I was doing and able to look forward to the next job.
Thank you. It's a beautiful story.
It's really good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Piggybacking on that, I'm a United Methodist pastor, and at least in our denomination, you get sent to one, then another, then another, and each time you move, you're sort of picked up out of the community you've come to love. Mm-hmm. Parachuted into another one, and very strong boundaries not to engage with your previous one. So you become, just like you were saying about foster care, I'm a sojourner here. I'm here to serve these people, but you know, they're not here to serve me.
Yeah. Well, in the Luzon Church, we have that too. When we let go, you know, from one congregation to another, we're not supposed to have any more relationships with the previous congregation.
One of the challenging things, part of my training involved spending a lot of time with the goodbyes as people would come to see me as a pastoral counselor, a therapist. And when all of a sudden someone, like, don't need an appointment, don't have an appointment, and we've made an emotional connection, and, you know, feelings of how dare you do that, but they pay the bill. I mean, you know, it's their call. It's not my call. But I'm aware of those feelings too. It's the feelings of will they come back or will they won't come back.
Well, another challenge is taking care of yourself if you have to take care of someone who has dementia or Alzheimer's or. My mom is 90 years old, and you know, she'll be 90 next month. So, you know, going to visit her is so much different now than it was when I was, say, 40.
Yeah.
You know, and so oftentimes
spending a day with her is so emotionally exhausting that I have nothing left at the end of the day for my husband, because I just have no energy whatsoever. So the challenge then is living with those situations and taking care of yourself as well.
And the reality is your mother is not the same mother.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you're already bringing up something that this slide gives attention to. What often happens with ambiguous loss, and these responses are really fall on a continuum of being more or less severe. Our emotions can be confusing and baffled, and we can feel helpless and angry. We have grief and sadness, and we feel bad about having sadness. There's also the physical component too. You know, if it gets to be more intense, we can notice it in our diet or after a tough period of time. We either eat too much, or we don't eat enough, or we eat the wrong things, or sleep is affected, blood pressure, regular exercise. We just don't have that energy to do it anymore, because there's so much energy that's involved in living with an ambiguous loss. Daily living routines can be affected. Certainly the use of substances, alcohol, as a way of dealing or numbing the conflicts that we're feeling inside, misuse of that. There's an interpersonal component to it. We use our time and our energies in different ways than we did before. Fun changes. Or we don't allow ourselves to have fun. Or we don't have the energy to have fun, or we do things that other people are having fun, but it's not fun to us. Preoccupation with that focus and with that concentration, you know. There's a sense of being zoned out. People, your loved ones or companions, they look at you and we really have a different place of focus. Maybe it's less in common with old friends, and hopefully we have those kinds of friends too who are able to say, hey, what's going on? Or, you know, you're not with me. Or, you know, give a jab or give a, that comes across as being caring, not as accusing. Spiritual life. Faith can be at a crossroads. That which used to we appear have such a sense of certainty about may have some doubts attached to it. For a new arena of life, we've never been at this place before. So it's brand new. And I think what happens in the aging process, even though we have a lot of years to us, is the first time we've experienced something like this. And I, speaking of clergy, did a lot of therapy with clergy from many different denominations, some of whom were second career, who were very successful at their career. And, you know, we're at crossroads in dealing with the kind of stuff that you deal with in the parish, and expectations and disappointments. And I found myself saying, but you've never been this before. And they saw themselves as such a accomplished professional. And they are. But they're doing something brand new. And it takes experience and working through those experiences that enables the movement ahead. And I think with ambiguous losses, wherever we're at in life, the same thing. I've never had this experience with my father-in-law before, and now with my mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. And there are limitations on models. You know, growing up, we have all kinds of models. We have mentors who've been there, done that, and hopefully have a way of conveying they're with us and giving encouragement. But we don't have those mentors, our models, at such a time that ambiguous losses can happen, which is one of the most significant experiences I had in my ministry at Lutheran Counseling Services. It was in the early 1990s. Was able to identify like four or five different families who had a loved one who was diagnosed with a mental illness. And they formed a group, and they met once every 2 weeks, or then later on after, they kept going for like 2 to 3 years, once a month, and listening to them, helping them to talk about these conflicting feelings of loving their family member, but yet hating the kind of situations that they had to deal with. And what happened was a bonding that took place between them. And when they couldn't come to the group, is that they were even call one another, "Are you okay?" You know, we can find that. We can find that in the parish too. We can find that in our church community. But we often don't. And when it's there, it's really a gift of God, that people know us well enough and know what's inside of us so they can be accepting of that. Because it's that being accepted of what we're going through that is so healing and so powerful and so encouraging. Questions can arise, where is God? Or how to understand what it is that I'm experiencing? I think one of the challenges I had as a pastor was wanting to tell people where God was for them, more in my early years than in my later years. But rather than helping them to explore for themselves where their God presence was and where God wasn't present, and to engage that so that there could be a spiritual growth within them.
Well, a good example is Al-Anon and AA.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And people come from all sorts of walks of life, and nobody shares what their occupation is. Everybody's accepted the way they are, and, you know, the way they see God. And you say the prayer, "God grant me the serenity." You know, the serenity prayer.
Thank you. Excellent. Yeah, excellent example. And the when there's a good AA group, you just don't find acceptance at that level that you find elsewhere.
Yeah. When you said where God is and where God isn't, were you talking about where they see God?
Pardon?
Where they see God.
Yes.
Or where they don't see God?
Both?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the reality is, well, my theology tells me that in the deepest places, that's where the cross is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to be able to journey into there, it's a journey that may feel isolated and alone. But from a faith perspective, you know, it's discovering, listening, waiting, allowing time to be a process.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I meant it. And the why me, the why now, even our prayer life changes. And that's okay. Often it may not be just words, it may be feelings. And we end it by saying, "Oh God." What often happens with ambiguous loss, and there are a continuum of responses dealing with our whole person, because it affects us as whole people. What helps? Emotionally, it helps with ambiguous loss to understand what's happening. When loss is confusing, it exhausts. A lot of energy is spent. And sometimes that energy is spent because we want to clamp down our emotions. And it takes energy to clamp them down. I'm not talking about the kind of emotion that wants you to go find a rapid-fire rifle or to take your vehicle and drive it off of a cliff. You know, that's moves it into another area. But when loss is confusing, it exhausts. And
I think that's where Kubler-Ross's work,
pardon?
Loss, was really important, because I think it helped many in our population understand that you go through stages, and you could say, it's okay for me to feel angry, or, oh, that person must be really still in denial. So I think it's helped us a lot to have that formation, because, or that formulation, because without that, like you said, it's just exhausting, confusing, and you can't even begin to think that somebody else has experienced the same thing, or that I'm normal, because why am I still feeling this way?
Well, what happens too when we get that affirmation is it's empowering. Mm-hmm. And when we feel it, it's disempowering. When we feel helpless. And when we feel helpless, we often are helpless. If we feel like we're in a corner, in a bind, we don't give ourselves options. And when someone affirms that we're there, it becomes, hey, I've got options, and it's empowering. We can't problem solve, because the problem is somewhere between final and temporary. And if our, the person or the object is or is not coming back, that place of ambiguity. We don't want to talk, yet we need to talk. Again, to reemphasize this point of understanding and acceptance as being so vital. That's where people can just taught me over the years, a non-judgmental posture with people. Not that I would allow them to do stupid things or to do illegal things or try to involve me in that, but to come across as being understanding and accepting. I found too that if someone has had a deep emotional wound in their life, for instance, childhood abuse, that it takes longer to develop that sense of acceptance, that they feel they're being accepted, and that trust takes place, which is so vital in enabling the healing, enabling the living with. When ambivalence is mixed with ambiguity, it also can move into an emotional roller coaster, because you may have feelings of okay about it and then not okay. You're ambivalent, as well as dealing with something that is ambiguous. I call it the double A. So when we're trying to understand within ourselves or working with someone else or helping someone else, to be able to for that person to articulate both the ambivalence as well as the lack of clarity is key to bring about understanding. Yeah, Ed.
This too shall pass, is that helpful in any of this?
Yeah. It's helpful if they say it.
But you don't say it to them.
It's more helpful to say, what's it like now? Yeah.
Do you have anything from your experience that could help those who of us who have at times dealt with somebody who could really benefit from getting some help with loss, whatever, and just are so set against seeking out help? In your experiences, do you have anything that could help a family member or a loved one with working with that situation and in terms of encouraging someone?
Well, I think it involves a level of trust between you and that person. That level of trust. Mm-hmm. And to pose it as a question. I think when we come across with people, they come across when it sounds like judgment, like you need, this could be helpful for you, mm-hmm. that could be experienced as you're not managing too well.
Got it.
But to have it come from them to reduce that sense of judgment from a theological perspective, it comes across as grace. You know, you're given, you're supplying something, and you're a friend, and you're aware, sounds like you're really hurting and you've been hurting for a long time. Mm-hmm. It helps to understand that the previous roles in relationships and the rules of the relationship freeze in place, and the old organization no longer works. Your example of your mother, mm-hmm. I think, is an excellent one that fits in that. That the kind of role that you have with your mother is different now. You articulated it very well. Mm-hmm. And the rules of the relationship, you are a caregiver.
Right.
Yeah, big time. And that rule wasn't acknowledged. Something didn't take place to say, this is a different rule. It evolved slowly and ambiguously. Uh-huh. And maybe there were moments of you saw your old mother there. Mm-hmm. And that were, hey, this is energizing. But more often than not, it's a different kind of person. Do we let go? Do we let go of the old, or do we hold on? Part of the challenge is the reality is that we're holding on to two things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the challenges involve about changing or not changing to the new realities. By changing, I mean within ourselves. It's so much of our life. What is it that I can alter? And I think your example of working with the children was excellent. You changed something in you, and how you understood your role with them. It helps to understand that symbolic rituals that ordinarily support and verify and validate a clear loss are affected. For instance, when we lose a friend, a loved one, generally there is a funeral, there is a burial, and there's possibly something in the paper that acknowledges it. It's very clear. The symbolic ritual of funeral is no longer there at a time of ambiguous loss. I think from a faith perspective and a pastoral perspective, we have a lot to offer. As we know people going through that, we can actually verbalize something that is no longer there, hopefully in a way that doesn't come across as judgmental, but comes across as understanding and a struggle. I mean, like living with the loss of a loved one, life has changed.
I have an example. I've just retired as an ER nurse at Seattle Children's, and we were fortunate enough to build a new emergency room about 4 years ago. And so we were leaving the space that we had worked in for, in my case, 35 years. And I had seen sudden infant death, I had seen traumatic death, I had seen cancer. And I said, you know, we have to leave this place. We have to close this place down. Mm-hmm. We're not just going to put a sign up one day, go to this entrance, and now you walk into a new physical space. And it was like, fortunately, my leadership recognized that I made a point, got our chaplaincy involved as well. And we actually did. We closed that ER down because I have people that had very significant situation. We knew we all had more in our whatever. And it allowed us to open our new space in a way that still had acknowledged all that had gone before. And I sometimes think that when an elderly person moves out of their home of 40 years and is going to a nursing home or a senior center, we miss an opportunity to help them with that adjustment by acknowledging that, leaving a sacred space of their life and starting a new one.
Yeah.
I think there's a parallel for this with the number of times I've heard people going through a divorce say it would be easier if they died.
Uh-huh.
Because what they're saying is there's no ritual, there's no clear loss that everybody acknowledges and honors, you know. It gets very ambiguous with the judgments and all.
Yeah, we often, for instance, in congregations, when people, they move and they say they're moving, to acknowledge that within the congregation, to even have a prayer, that can be so helpful.
Yeah.
If you get a large congregation, people, you know, they're not there anymore, you say, what happened?
Right. Yeah.
And you never see them before. It's the acknowledgement of it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it just remains ambiguous.
Right.
Yeah.
Or when a colleague, for instance, in ministry, is for some reason removed and they just disappear and no one can talk about why they were removed or what happened, or there's no way of acknowledging we just lost a friend.
Yeah.
I call that often an emotional cutoff.
Yeah.
Sure. Before there was an interchange of emotions and a cutoff. Yeah. You know, something I did. Or, you know, you're left unknown. Yes.
Well, there's a term for that now, ghosting.
What? Pardon?
Ghosting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When people just disappear.
I still didn't hear you. But
ghosting.
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 Ghosting somebody is just, you know, dropping.
I've never heard that, but I like that.
Yeah.
Stop reading their emails and their texts and just,
just disappear.
Or people do that from jobs.
Or someone they're dating.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
Oh, is it on Facebook? It's on Facebook?
Well, I mean, it can happen in a lot of ways, but just to silently disappear from someone's life without saying goodbye.
Yeah. I don't know if you can read that. We can have unrealistic expectations about what puts us at reach. That goat's climbing up a hill and the one on top says, I hate to break it to you guys, but it's kind of the same up here as it was down there. What hinders or does not help with ambiguous loss? Some of these have already been touched on. It's the mindset of one right way to respond. Cultures and religions see loss and way to respond differently. Different regions of the country have different mores. Spent a lot of time in South Carolina in which is much different than Seattle, Washington. And mastery as a goal. I need to master this tension I'm feeling, this feeling one way, feeling another. And because I don't master it, I'm really a failure. Or can allow myself to go down that dark road of not being valued. Different pieces of this idea of deal with it, move on quickly. That's where the quantitative versus qualitative view of time from Ecclesiastes 3 can can be of help. All the ingredients of change is acceptance is still stewing, and that's okay. When it doesn't become okay is when it affects other people's lives to the extent that it's damaging, and then that's another level of intervention. And I don't want to overstep that. Such a goal is never completely mastered and leads to increased frustration, detachment, disassociation, or even a sense of failure. And the reality is, from a faith perspective, is God loves us the way we are. In between, along that continuum, wherever we are. And that can be helpful, I think, from a spiritual perspective, and I speak as a pastor, you know, to be able to articulate that. The dimensions of the place and the power of trust. When we have the trusting relationship of someone else. I was involved a lot in my work with the Army Reserve in suicide prevention. As you may know, there have been too many soldiers after the war who come home and continue to commit suicide. That became, the command noticed it, and when the command noticed it, it affects the mission. So the chaplains were given a role of educating. And the point that they wanted us to make, which is easy to make, is that the best prevention of suicide is a trusting relationship. Mm-hmm. Is a trusting relationship. Faith often questioned and prayer life affected. That, and to come across and to allow that to be, that you know, my faith is raising some issues that weren't raised before. That doesn't minimize my faith life. It has the possibility of strengthening it. It has the possibility of growing with it. It's definitely out of our comfort zone, though. And to acknowledge the fact that our comfort zone has been affected is a way of not being hindered. Okay, this is opening up a question, and time is up, but we could spend a lot of time on this one. How do people in positions of leadership and authority affect attitudes and behavior around ambiguous laws? You know.
Number 45.
What does that mean?
T-R-U-I-P. The 45th.
Okay. I love this cartoon. Woman telling her husband, if you're bored with yourself, imagine how I feel.
Left is good. Yeah.
Learning from one another, and our time is up, and this was next to my last slide. I invite you to come back Friday at 4, and it'll even more specificity around what helps and what to expect with ambiguous loss.
Is it okay to use that line on your kid?
Say it again.
If you use that line on your kid, if you're bored with yourself, imagine how I.
I think that's a good one. The same idea of emotional elasticity is something I'll be talking with you about. How do we allow ourselves to have that elasticity, to have that movement within our emotions that possibly we didn't have before? It is 5:00, and thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.
And your conversation.